Welcome to Season 4 of The Farcast, bringing you experts and insiders every week to help you navigate the economic and investing landscape. And now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to The Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is June the 3rd. Here we go, the last month of the second quarter here in 2021. And in spite of, you know, a couple of days of doldrums and a, you know, kind of a sort of performance from stocks, things really aren't that bad. Dow is still trading at around 34,500. S&P still at that 4,200 level. NASDAQ, 13,500, 13,600 or so. This morning, things aren't bad. The 10-year Treasury holding in at 1.59%. Dollar has kind of found a bottom. Oil is going up. What does it all mean? Is the big rally over, or are we just in the June doldrums here? Should we have sold in May? We're going to ask our friend and great Farcast guest, your fan favorite. Welcome back, Jim Urio.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
You are great to be with us. We always learn so much. So, Jim, here we are coming into the final month of the second quarter. What do you make of it? What are we seeing in markets? Is this rolling out the way you expected?
Well, I guess so. The thing with the equity markets is I'm still bullish-ish. You know, we've come a long way. I definitely want to see us make a salt at the old highs. I think it was Friday of last week, we put in a high in the S&P of 4230. I want to see us take that out as an indication of the short-term strength. The fundamentals are the same as they've always been. We have a Fed that's not going to be quick to raise rates. The Fed, you know, we had that CPI number, remember, a couple of weeks ago, and everybody got scared. They weren't scared of inflation. They were scared that the Fed could no longer ignore inflation. And what we've seen so far is the Fed has an ability to keep ignoring it and pretending that it's not really there and call it transitory or whatever the words they're using are now. So the market wants to believe that they're not going to do anything. They're not. There's also been another $6 trillion spending package talked about. When we start talking about numbers like this, you probably don't want to be in the dollar. You want to be in other things. And again, when you, I know you're going to ask something about AMC and the meme stocks, and you probably know that I traded GameStop last week, and I feel tremendous guilt for having made money on that stupid stock. But I did. But all of this is just a function of so much money being pumped into the system, and it ends up in ludicrous places. And that's what we're seeing.
You know, I find that when you make a profit and when you really have a fair amount of cash after any trade, it really does assuage the guilt, doesn't it?
I mean, a little bit. But
I mean, I feel guilty, but I feel guilty with a lot of cash in my pocket. So I'll be okay.
I mean, and maybe it's a short guy thing for me, but you know how I like to be high and mighty and point to people and say, you're going to get burned on this and act like I'm smarter than that. And then I just jump right in with everybody else. But yes, making a little bit of money felt good.
Well, you know, I think wisdom and a discipline are one thing. And then, you know, you get somebody with your years of experience who says, I'm seeing momentum that I'm just going to step into that stream and catch. I mean, I see the momentum. I'm going to play the momentum. And I know that the trade is stupid. And you can do that. But the average guy doesn't have your experience. And this is where the average guy thinks he's you and he's not.
Well, here, okay, this is an interesting point that you bring up. Okay, so I have, you know, charts going up all day long. And a guy sent me the GameStop chart, and I had it up there. And I noticed that not only hadn't it been talked about very much in the previous weeks, it had traded in a relatively tight range. And now at the same time, the rhetoric started to pick up. At the same time, it looked like it was going to break out of that range. Now, so when something that's trading not on fundamentals at all and only on technicals, and technicals is just taking the temperature of the, you know, of the group mentality, it seemed like an easy play.
Right.
But again, all these things are trading. They might as well be just some imaginary thing like widgets, because they're trading, you know, miles and miles ahead of what.
I mean, they might as well be like Bitcoin.
Exactly. Oh, good one. You nailed it. Or Dogecoin is even better. I mean, there are some smart people I know who think that Bitcoin has a place in our future, but I'm not sure anyone thinks that Dogecoin does.
You said you are bullish-ish. I like that when you said that.
Bullish-ish.
That's pretty good. So you think that you get a little more spending this year? We have earnings that are recovering. You got a lot of, you know, the reopening trade. You've still got all these consumers with all this cash, these high savings rate. That doesn't drive stocks higher by year end?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think it does. But you have to keep in mind that it's driven it quite a bit higher already. Now, we're going through this long term. We've gone through the rotation out of the FANG names, out of the places that people hid and people stored their money as kind of a safety trade, and the work from home trade for, you know, 6-8 months. And we're unwinding that. And that's a difficult thing to do because, it's like a needle that you have to thread when you're changing leadership roles. And all of a sudden, we're down 30 this morning, which I don't think is a big deal in the S&Ps. But if it starts to spill a little bit, selling begets selling once people get bulled up quite a bit, and people are. So again, I'm bullish-ish, but I need to see a trade back above 42.30 to confirm that the rest of the world is bullish-ish, and then I'll get a little more long.
Jim Labenthal said something, two things actually last week that I thought were very good. When you get into the doldrums, when you get into this shoulder period of a quarter, I mean, because we go through this period of a quarter every quarter, you get into the third month, the earnings are out. We got a Fed meeting coming in a couple of weeks that everybody's going to start talking about, but that's still a couple of weeks. So there's no real news driving markets. He says that's the time, number one, when you look at technicals. The other thing that he said, was that the greatest risk is not being invested in stocks right now. Longer term, he said, you've got to be a bull in here. The stock market over the bond market, the stock market over cash, the stock market over anything else, you got to own stocks now. You agree with that in here?
Yeah, I say I want to be invested long term, and I think stocks are going higher. But when he started naming other things that didn't seem to him as good as stocks, that's where we separate a little bit too. I think that crude oil, silver are the things that I've been trading mostly this
week. Why is crude oil $60 a barrel? I mean, right next to Bitcoin that I never understand is oil.
What the funny thing is, like when the commodity thing all started to happen, everyone was ignoring crude. I think part of that was a notion that it was going to get the crap regulated out of it by the new administration,
right,
and some of the oil names in wire. But I think ultimately people look at crude and say, hey, wait a minute, there's just as easy an argument to be made for higher crude as regulations come about. And the integrated names trade with that. So I've been buying those last week and this week, as I've said relatively publicly. I think that it was like musical commodity chairs and crude oil was the empty chair. And now that, you can't buy lumber, you can't buy copper, I think they're going to jump into crude and drive that up to $75.
Drive it up to $75. Will you? I think at one point, did you tell me that you were looking for it to see if it broke above 60, that was really going to be a point that interested you? Yeah, I remember that you said that. Right, right. So you're still, the trades looks like it's going in your direction at this point, huh?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. From the beginning of the year, I liked crude and I liked banks. I remember the first show we did of the year. Those are the two things I like the best. And nothing's dissuaded me from that yet. The thing I even like about the banks is that I bought it for a yield curve steepening trade, and the yield curve stopped steepening and the banks still held in. So I'm switching it in my mind now to a reopening trade. Realistically, most of my stuff is technical, probably 60-70%, but I'd like to have a nice fundamental thesis to back it up, to buttress it a little bit. And let's just say that maybe banks are part of the reopening trade along with oil.
So we're going to own those too. At the Fed changing course here a little bit, are they starting? Was this the first tap of the brakes maybe to get out of some of these corporates and ETFs and whatever the hell else they were done? I mean, the dollar figure's not important, but certainly perhaps just saying we're going to change something here is the beginning of their ability to actually reverse course. What do you think?
I think that it's interesting. I think that throwing it out there has less to do with what their intent is and more to do with what the market will allow them to say or potentially do. I think it's hubris for the Fed to think that they're really in charge. If they start tightening or stop bond purchases and the stock market cracks 15%, they'll change their tune quickly. We've seen this happen before. I believe it was James Bullard back in, we'll call it 10 years ago. And one day he said the Fed was considering tightening. The market broke 8%, and the next speech was about how the situation has changed. Literally, it was a day or two later.
Well, so if you need something to change, follow Bullard. I mean, I love Jim Bullard. He's a really nice guy, but God, that guy changes like the breeze.
Yeah, and I understand things sometimes do change, but the only thing that changed that day was that the stock market broke 7 or 8%. So, I think that is the Fed going to be supportive of the stock market? Of course they are. They don't want to be sitting at the helm when everything falls to pieces. And I think that's the wrong way to think of it, but I understand it. I'd probably do the same thing. That's why I'm not the Fed chairman, I guess. Yeah.
Right. So I've got two final questions for you, Jim. And this has been very, very interesting. Thank you. One, what keeps you awake at night right now? What has you worried?
Well, I do think that the Fed and the government spending and modern monetary theory is forcing a bubble. I do believe that the bubble's relatively widespread across assets, and that's a good thing, because if they could thread that needle and just bubble up everything, then you don't have your plumber brother-in-law mortgaging his house to buy a certain asset that's going higher, then right. they could actually win this. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're in some stage of bubble creation, particularly in the equities. I believe we're probably 80% done with inflating the bubble. And that's tough. It's a tough one to call because you don't want to miss the last 20%. But it's time for me to start being more cautious, being more, I replicate my long positions with options, with defined risk, because I don't want to lose everything I've made. So that's what keeps me up at night.
You know, Dr. Jay Bryson, chief economist at Wells Fargo, is going to be our guest for our third segment this morning. I read something he wrote just a couple of days ago, and he said something that sort of scared me in there. He said, young economists who are now populating world central banks, there's new younger economists who never seen the inflation risk that we've had before. They see inequality as risk number one and no longer inflation as risk number one. And this economic inequality is really the enemy to be fought, yes. The foe to be fought. And central banks are sort of shifting to do that. Certainly, fiscal policy here in the U.S. has done that with all of the checks that have gone out. We really addressed the lower part of the economy. We didn't just go after the financial institutions here with the great pandemic solution. So there seems to be a different kind of risk. And the question is, does anybody really think that we're going to have to pay for this someday? Because I'm old, and I think we will.
This is asinine. When the government tries to get in and fix wealth inequality, there's one thing that you can rest assured will happen, as that is they will increase wealth inequality. Even the program that you mentioned with dispersing checks, decreasing the dollar. The poor people got $1,400. Yours and my assets rose hundreds of thousands of dollars based on the whole scramble to get out of dollars and into things. And they cannot fix wealth inequality. The notion that wealth inequality in itself is a bad thing is ludicrous. Wealth inequality in a dynamic economy is essential. What they're talking about is excessive wealth inequality. And I agree that that's become a bit of a problem when you try to figure out how to do that. And one way to do that is to let rates normalize and let people build wealth without stepping so far out the risk curve that every 12 years they get hammered in a bubble bust situation. So, yes. I mean, when those people start talking about fixing wealth inequality, be careful. They're going to exacerbate wealth inequality. I'll guarantee it.
Well, and I've been saying there's nothing, absolutely, I don't have anything wrong as a free market capitalist with wealth inequality. I do, from an economic point of view, have a problem with a concentration of dollars in few hands that can't move. You've got to get a lot of money in a lot of hands if you're going to drive economic activity.
Amen.
And the concentration of the dollars impairs the economy. But that there's a disparity in those who have dollars and those who don't. That's not the problem. The problem is that you can't drive an economy when you get that concentration. Finally, give us some advice for Fred and Ethel, and we're going to get out of here. Between now and the end of the year, they're looking at their 401k. Should they reallocate? What should they be worried about, Jim?
I always say that I'll just tell you what I'm doing. I don't know Fred and Ethel's risk tolerance or the depth of their pockets, but I will say this, is that I agree with Jim Liebenthal to a certain extent, and that I'm not getting out of any stocks. I am rebalancing. I am buying some protections. Rebalancing is always going to be my key to staying, to sleeping at night. Is if you go 6 months or if you go a year and you see that your stocks have absolutely exploded, you take some risks off the table. With 401ks and tax deferred instruments, it's easy to do that and not take any big, huge capital gains risk. So I say, don't get greedy. Bears can make money. Bulls can make money. Pigs get slaughtered is what we always say here.
Play it down the middle with Jim Muriel. He's been doing this for over 30 years as a professional. He's managing director at TJM Institutional Services. And don't forget, the owner of the best burger restaurant in the world, Brandt's of Palatine. You get out to Chicago, you go to Brandt's, and you get your 10% Farcast discount. Ask for Jim while you're there. Jim, thanks so much. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to come back with Dan Mahaffey and figure out what is going on in Washington, and are they really going to spend another $1 trillion when we come back on the Farcast.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Hero's work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Hero's mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. Welcome back to the Farcast, and now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Dan Mahaffey joins us now from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. They study the presidency and Congress so you don't have to. And isn't that a relief, ladies and gentlemen, that you don't have to fool with all of these folks in Washington? Dan, also the senior political analyst on the Farcast, well into our fourth season now. Going to be in the fifth season in the fall. Can't believe it, Dan. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be
back. Lots to talk about this morning, Dan. We're getting Netanyahu is going to be gone, it looks like, in Israel. Though, you know, there's something that I'm watching in that discussion, in that race, in that overthrow, that I'm still not really willing to count him out. I mean,
yeah, no. Bibi is a political Nosferatu. Until there's a stake through his heart, I don't see him leaving the Israeli political scene. Look, they have a deal. It's one of the most tenuous political deals in Israeli history when you consider that you have the secular party, the settlers party, and the Islamist party all together. I think it's fascinating too what we're going to see in Washington if this government does stand. Look, you're going to have Israeli members of the Knesset who are a hair's breadth away from the Muslim Brotherhood, yes, now in government in one of our, yes, key allies. So this is, I think, one showing how so many of the religious fault lines are being reshaped by just the practical effect of geopolitics in the region, the Arab Spring, the instability in Israel, the questions over the two-state solution, and whether Likud was moving Israel towards becoming an apartheid state. Those are all things that have Israel in a very tenuous position right now. And as I said, look, this deal still needs to be voted on in the parliament. The speaker of the Knesset is not a nonpartisan figure. He can delay this vote. There's questions about whether individual MKs will defect. So, look, historically,
handicap it for us, Dan. I hear all of that. Handicap it. What are the odds that Netanyahu stays?
I say there's still probably about a 35% chance Netanyahu at least doesn't stay, but at least gets to another election.
Gets to another election. Okay, 35%. So that means then, Dan, that there is a significant 65% chance that Netanyahu is gone. And how does that change the face of Israel and indeed the Middle East?
Well, the question is, how much hold does he control on the Likud party and the public of Israel? Does he become sort of Israel's Trump when he's out of office? Does he have that influence?
Okay, so does he?
I don't think so, because he also has, well, you know, here's the parallel. There's the corruption charges chasing him. The question becomes for Likud in that party there, can they win without Netanyahu? If they start to think they can, and perhaps the lesson of this last election was that they would have won, but for the clouds of corruption over Netanyahu, then they're more willing to cast him aside. Here in the US, if it's like with former President Trump, where they say, we can't win without Netanyahu, then he's still got a hold on the party.
Right. And one of the things that Republicans did discuss, and some are still discussing, is, you know, can President Trump, former President Trump, through the various lawsuits or whatever, become enough of a liability that they will just jettison? These are politicians, ladies and gentlemen. The loyalties don't exist.
Right.
If they seem to exist, they don't exist. The old buy a dog if you want a friend in Washington is not funny. It,
yeah,
really is a really sad comment in Washington, because it is so, so desperately true. So come on back with me here, Dan. Let's say this government changes, Israel changes its government. What does that do to the politics of the Middle East? Does the Middle East become less stable without the current Israel-led Netanyahu leadership?
I don't think it becomes less stable because you one, the defense portfolio is not changing between governments. You keep the same minister of defense. Bennett, who will be the first prime minister, is no dove on many of these things.
Okay.
I don't think you see many policies change specifically as much as, and look, there's a little bit of the, like, for example, there's now going to be legalized weed in Jerusalem. So I went and bought the Burning Bush dispensary trademark. But at the same time, these are little social things that I think don't reflect as much as we see in the U.S., but are actually very important in that Orthodox versus secular tension in Israeli domestic politics.
Did you get burningbush.com or burningbushdude.com?
I think if my team was right, we bought every related.
You got them all. That's great. Yeah. I want to move now. I'm going to move around the world from Israel a bit further to the north. Let's see, east from Israel. Yes. To China, please. Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, it's
a little northeast. Yeah.
Great okay. Circle wrap.
We'll go that way around.
Yeah.
All right. It's a much longer way if we have to go west. So let's go northeast. You can get there either way, folks. Isn't that wonderful?
We'll take the Silk Road.
It's wonderful. So, Secretary Yellen, and Minister Huh?
Liu He, yep.
Huh, which is spelled H-U, ladies
H-E.
And gentlemen. Huh? H-E?
H-E, yeah.
He.
He.
Huh. Huh. Yeah, that right. All right. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. I'm trying to be funny. And I understand that comedy is going to die with this younger generation. My generation is going to be quietly still making inappropriate jokes on the golf course. I don't mean offense. I'm just trying to lighten things up a little bit. They had a decent conversation, right? Catherine Tai is making some progress. Or no, Dan, what's going on?
Look, I think they want to keep the trade relationship going. It's the complexity of U.S.-China competition, where it's shop till you drop on one hand and then prepare for war on the other. And it's the administration has to.
How do you do that?
Well, you look at where we still find areas of mutual interest. We don't want to, we want to have a stable global macroeconomic environment. We agree on that. We both agree on the need for trying to pursue what was put in place by this trade deal. There's not going to be any movement on the U.S. side on tariffs anytime soon. But again, having the Chinese see that dialogue as important for stability. And I think we need to focus on, again, differentiating out what is commoditized, truly part of the global economy, and then what's separate, what's the high tech, high security stuff. And that's what the administration is trying to do. How long you can balance those and walk that tightrope is I think the challenge for this administration.
Yeah, so I'm hearing the Chinese. I mean, when I hear this, I hear the Chinese saying the nice things they say about the U.S. And the Chinese, when you do business with the Chinese, they always very, very flattering, lots of nice things that typically don't mean anything in the long term. So they're saying now, we want to do business with you. We want to benefit, mutual benefits economically, and we're still going to absolutely ignore all of your rules. We will do whatever's in China's interest at every damn turn and screw you. But we'd still like to make a dollar over here. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be just absolutely ruthless with you as we always have been. But if we can make nice long enough so we can make a dollar, good for us. And we're going to let them do that?
And we've got to balance that too, because as long as Apple, Walmart want to make a dollar, they're reliant on China and Chinese manufacturing. So it's how do you, until these major U.S. firms have either found alternate ways of doing business or changed their business plans. Look, it's as much the same.
The balance. Second largest economy in the world, right?
Yeah, it's the same reason.
We got to do something with them.
You got to do something. It's the same reason John Cena is there apologizing in Mandarin for calling Taiwan a country. It's embarrassing. It's not pretty, but it's the reality.
Taiwan is a country, is it not?
Well, I think Taiwan is a de facto country, but we think I just got this show banned on the mainland. So there we go.
I always, I always thought that Pluto was a planet.
Yes.
I always thought that Saint Christopher was a saint. You know, I'm very anachronistic.
Well, we reach all these points and arguments. Geopolitics change. Look, the circumstances change. And I look at Taiwan and China arguments and I say, just substitute out the word Ireland for Taiwan. And it's the same arguments the Brits had in the 1890s and 1920s.
I'm moving right along here, Dan, of course, running a little tight. So it's a productive conversation with Yellen and
it's productive to keep the trade relationship moving, to avoid that kind of rupture and manage tensions in the fields you can.
And you say, huh?
Huh. The oh, huh.
Huh. When Dan says it, Dan actually speaks Mandarin. I'm just trying to parrot back whatever sounds he makes. So listen to Dan. Elizabeth McDonough is the Senate parliamentarian. Now, yes. This is a little wonky, ladies and gentlemen, but it's a big deal. She could be the most powerful person in Washington, D.C., as we shift a little more into Washington here this morning. Dan, why does Farr say that Elizabeth McDonough could be the most powerful person in Washington?
Well, she has slightly adjusted the ruling on reconciliation that you could get the
budget. This is a Senate rule.
Yeah, the Senate rule to get the budget reconciliation through. One saying that, look, there needs to be either some sense of economic crisis or situation to respond to justify an additional budget, as well as saying that there would need to be another vote, you know, budget resolution process that opens up the whole voting structure. End of the day, you know, look, we could have a long podcast called Senate Rules with Dan Mahaffey, and it would be better than
no
Ambien.
One would ever listen to
it'd
it.
Be
right.
Better than Ambien if you ran out of your sleeping pills.
Right.
But the point of this is that the Democrats don't have the free rein they once probably thought they did. Again, I don't think it shuts off some of their plans for if they have to move infrastructure on a partisan basis. It's just a little more circumscribed about it.
But let me break this down for just 1 second, Dan. Let me interrupt and break it down. Yeah. Typically, to get a vote passed through the Senate, you need 60 votes.
Correct.
60 votes. And then there are these loopholes that they can that you can use from time to time. And one of them is this the reconciliation. It's a procedure in the Senate, and it takes it down on certain issues in certain circumstances to a 51 vote majority so
correct.
That we have 50 Republicans and 50 Democrats, and a Democratic vice president means that if you get all 50 Democrats plus the vice president voting for the Democrats, you get a 51 vote majority, and
right.
that moves stuff through, which means you can do something with your entire party backing, even if the entire full 50 senators of the other party disagree with you. And that's how they got this budget thing through at the beginning of this year, the $1.9 trillion that were passed. And now we want to spend more money. And they're trying to find another way to do another reconciliation. Typically, it's one a year. Maybe there can be a second one during this year. If that comes in the fall, that means that Biden, President Biden, is going to get some sort of additional spending bill for infrastructure coming most likely in the fall, probably September. And what can they get in that bill? But right now, actually, the Democrats were trying to get two more in, and this House parliamentarian said no. She said no, and that's probably
right,
good for the Republic.
It lumps it into one. I think you avoid abusing the, you know, because this is designed to be a way to at least keep the budget process going. But finally, it doesn't change the math that Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, and other moderate Democrats are just as important, or if not more important, as they still were in determining what shape this takes and when. Do they say it's time to end the bipartisan negotiations with the Republican senators?
There are voting bills now changing, moving a little bit more broadly across the U.S. now, Dan. Voting bills in different states, particularly Texas. People are very upset. We saw them very upset about the voting bill changes in Georgia, which seem to restrict the ability of the minority voters and poor voters to vote, restricting voting rights. And these are typically being passed by more Republican-driven majorities,
right.
Particularly in Texas. What's going on? Give it to me very quickly, will you, Dan?
So much of this still comes from the belief that the 2020 election was stolen. Look, there are lots of ways to make voting harder in city areas and in urban areas. I ultimately think, look, this is counterproductive for Republicans. One, I think the blowback continues from corporate America on these measures. Two, suburban voters, a lot of minority voters are actually more motivated by what they see here. And third, I think it's actually counterproductive for Republicans because the Trump voter is actually your low frequency, low engagement voter. The suburban voter who votes in every local election primary, your lawyer, your doctor, right, they're not going to have trouble finding ID. And those are the people who have moved away from the Republican Party. So in the long run, I think a lot of these are counterproductive because where Republicans saw growth, Latinos along the Rio, yes, Grande in Texas, that's, yes, going to make it harder for them to vote. It's going to make it harder for a lot of the Hispanics in Miami, urbanites who that's where actually Trump saw relative growth in his votes. Now they're making it harder for them. And the suburbs where people have, look, I think most suburban Americans I know have voted consistently since their 18th birthday.
Right.
And that's the party that's the segment of the electorate that's fleeing away from Republicans right now. Because look, and I think this is something.
Is this going
to
keep happening all over the country? Are we going to see this continued push? Does it really
get
passed?
I think it is. I think it is. It does. It gets passed. And where I'm actually more worried is less about the voting access stuff, is where you see some of this stuff where you can say that, like, a judge can just overturn an election somewhere because he thinks it's fishy, or a state legislature can step in and change the outcome in a county. Stuff where that's being put in is actually where I see almost the being written in the ability to change elections after the fact if they don't go the way they go. And then what worries me is this is combined with an overall, I don't know any other way to put it, propaganda environment that says there is no way a Democrat can now win an election in America, not fraudulently.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is very important, and we're out of time with both my friend Dan Mahaffey. But this is very important because when you look at the U.S. economy, we have an educated workforce. We have contract and property laws. But we also have a peaceful transfer of power. We have a stable democratic government. And when you begin to change the rules and undermine the stability of a fair and orderly transfer of power, you begin to have problems that can erode the economic stability of a country. So that's why we have to watch this. Of the three things we've really talked about this morning, number one concern to me, probably in the most immediate terms, is what they're going to do, what's going to happen domestically for this next $1 trillion spending bill. I think that's a big deal. Number two, what happens between Yellen and Huh? That's a big deal. Our relationship with China economically, but then as we look to Israel, as we look to the voting bills here, all of this is going to affect markets. It's why we're covering it for you on the Farcast. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Jay Bryson, chief economist from Wells Fargo, one of the leading and brightest voices in the country, is going to explain what he's looking at right now in terms of perhaps a change of thinking in the Federal Reserve with a whole bunch of young economists more focused on inequality as risk number one rather than inflation. When we come back on the Farcast.
Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Segment three of the Farcast is a real treat, ladies and gentlemen. Jay Bryson, Managing Director and Chief Economist for Wells Fargo. This is one of the brightest guys you're ever going to hear really in the country, and largely, I think, around the world. He's worked at the Federal Reserve as an economist. You've seen him all over the television. He was a professor of economics, really a thought leader. Welcome back, Jay. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you, Michael. You're too kind, but it's always good to talk to you guys.
Well, we really appreciate it very much. Jay, here we are coming into the end of the second quarter. It looks like the economic recovery is well underway. Stock markets are doing pretty well. People are a little bit worried here about this inflation that may be coming. Let's start with your view of the economy. What are you seeing here for the next balance of this year and perhaps the following year for the U.S. economy, even the global economy? And then I want to get to inflation. But let's start with your view first.
Yeah, I mean, so if you look at the U.S. economy right now, I mean, we know in the first quarter we grew over 6%, we think we're going to be close to 10% annualized here in the second quarter.
Wow, isn't that terrific?
Yeah, and you know what it reflects, Michael, you know, as we all know, the economy's reopening again, right? You know, you're watching people going back to basketball games, full capacity, you know, restaurants are filling up, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the economy is really bouncing right now. Now, we do look for it to slow later this year and into next year. But, you know, the growth rates that we're talking about are probably still in the, you know, excess of 3% or so, maybe even 4%. I mean, these are good numbers. So the outlook for the economy, you know, for the foreseeable future, I think is pretty bright right now.
And that's what the Federal Reserve is saying. And yet we have people who are concerned clearly about inflation, about the prices, about asset inflation. We're seeing higher prices at the grocery store, certainly at the gas pump. We've seen higher prices in terms of education and health care, child care. Lots of costs going up, and we're hearing this term transitory from the Fed, like somehow it's going to be the, you know, rat through the snake, that prices go up, but they're going to come back down. I can't envision wages and wage inflation coming back down. So does it just mean that the inflation is going to go up and raise prices and then level off? Or what does this transitory mean that they're talking about?
Yeah, that's what it means. No one's talking about prices coming down. It's just that the rate of increase, and that's what inflation is, the rate of increase stops, or I should say slows. So I'll give you an example. So in April, you know, we got this big, you know, big number in terms of month-on-month change in inflation. And if you look at used car prices, yes, prices in April were up 10% relative to March. Is that going to continue? No, probably not. I mean, what's going on with used car prices? Well, you know, the automakers are having problems getting semiconductors right now, chips.
Yes.
And so production has halted for new car production in many places. So people are running out to buy used cars, and that's pushed the price up of those cars. Are prices of cars, used cars, going to continue to go up 10% per month for another year or so? No, probably not. That's probably going to slow down, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what we're seeing right now is year over year in April, the CPI was up 4%. Now that's from a low base of last year. But, you know, what it's saying is we're probably looking at a 4% or so inflation rate this year. But next year, the thinking is as the economy fully reopens, as the supply constraints ease up, as demand starts to cool off, you're looking at inflation rates coming back into the twos and threes again. That's what transitory means.
That's what transitory means. Okay. And, you know, Jay, one of the courses, when you look at some of these supply issues and demand issues, a year ago, we couldn't find Purell anywhere, or bleach or hand wipes or any of that stuff. Now we're up to our ears in Purell. You want Purell? We got Purell everywhere. They got buckets full of the stuff, right? Are we going to see that same phenomenon, do you think, with semiconductor chips over a year from now? Are there going to be plenty of them? Are there going to be plenty of used cars? I saw a stat from a boating website that said 35% of the boat traffic this summer will be from first-time boat owners, which, as a boater, scares the hell out of me. All of those people out there running into docks everywhere. 35%. You can't buy a boat anywhere right now, Jay. You can't find a new boat, a used boat. They're selling like hotcakes. Do you think a year from now you'll be able to buy any boat you want? I mean, there's going to be just a huge supply when people get sick of them?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think in general, what you are going to see is, I'm not a boating expert or semiconductor expert or anything of that nature, but there has been temporary, factories have been closed because you can't get people to work in those or restrictions, things of that nature. As we transition back to normal and as factories start to reopen and the supply chain kinks kind of get worked out, you'll see supply starting to come back online. And at the same time, a lot of this excess demand, which, you know, has been fueled by the COVID relief checks, the extended unemployment benefits, things of that nature, that stuff starts to come to an end. And the demand then starts to ratchet down as well. Supply starts to increase, so demand starts to ratchet down. That should start to bring price inflation back down. Again, we're not talking prices going down in general, but the rate of increase starts to slow.
Okay, and that's a brilliant description, I think, about why we don't have to worry too much about this transitory inflation, because there are some structural things in place that are going to slow down naturally as we go through the course of the year. And you just described them. The stimulus checks stop. There is sufficient supply. And all of a sudden, we really slow the rate of increase and it becomes more transitory. And yet you still sound fairly bullish and constructive still over the next couple of years. That bodes well, I would think, for stock prices, or no?
So I'm gonna use the economist's favorite clause here: everything else equal, right?
And why do you use that? Tell the audience why you're using that. Everything else being equal.
Well, because a lot of other things can potentially change here, right? I mean, so in an economy that's growing very, very quickly, that's good for profit growth, okay? And that's what, stock prices are based off of. The other thing they're based off of, though, are interest rates. And if the Fed gets spooked into raising rates, if long-term rates start to rise here, then investors have other alternatives for yield rather than just stocks. And so if you do see a big backup in rates here, what you start to get a rotation out of stocks into bonds, and therefore that wouldn't be quite as good for the overall stock market.
What do you make of the Fed's recent move here to sell $13.8 billion in their corporates? It's clearly not enough money to move any needle anywhere with the Federal Reserve. But that announcement, does that tell you they're going to change anything? I mean, why would they announce that now?
Well, I think what's going on is that facility is not needed. That was put in place when the pandemic hit over a year ago. Corporate credit markets were locking up and the Fed went in there to try to reliquify the corporate bond markets. That hasn't been needed for arguably a year or so. The corporate bond markets are performing very well right now. Credit spreads are very tight. People are looking for paper, good quality paper to invest in. The Fed doesn't need to be part of that anymore. And so they're just
winding it down now, though, Jay. Why now? I mean, are they sort of testing this idea that they might taper, or that they might buy less aggressively?
I think there's probably something to be said of that. There are people at the Fed who want to start tapering their purchases of, they're still buying treasury securities, they're still buying mortgage-backed securities as well. And so winding down this small little facility to see if there's any ramifications for the overall treasury market or the mortgage-backed security market, I mean, this could very well be an interesting trial balloon that they're putting up right now.
Well, we're going to watch that very closely. Where do you see, what keeps you awake at night right now, Jay? Where's the big risk?
Frankly, things I know about right now, I would say the big risk for me would be, I guess, inflation. Okay, now again, we have a pretty sanguine view of that, but I've been wrong before, I'll be wrong again.
And so don't talk silly. I don't remember you ever being wrong, nor do I ever think you're going to be wrong in the future.
I hope to minimize that. But if inflation does start to get out of control here and the Fed does feel like it's falling behind and has to start slamming on the brakes, that's clearly is an issue. But the other things the other risk, I think, to the economy, and we've seen this now twice in the last month, is cybersecurity attacks.
Yes.
On the infrastructure of the United States. Whether it's meatpacking plants, recently, whether it's the Colonial Pipeline, a few weeks ago, those bad actors aren't going away.
And
there's vulnerabilities out there in the system.
How does that affect your view of inflation? I mean, What would you, you worked at the Fed, you were a very important economist at the Federal Reserve. What would trigger a Fed action? What does it take to get the FOMC to take action? Is there a tipping point somewhere in there that you're watching for?
I think really, Michael, what it boils down to is inflation expectations. That's
yes.
a very important component of future inflation. You know, if you think inflation is going to be higher a year from now than it is today, that gives you an incentive to go out and buy goods and services today before
yes.
their price goes up. And then that yes. pushes their prices up. Okay, so if we see signs that inflation expectations, there's lots of ways you can measure it. You can measure it with like looking at bond yields. You know, if you see bond yields really start to back up, if you see surveys like the University of Michigan's survey,
yes.
Consumer price in data, if that starts to go up and people are really starting to get really concerned about inflation, then I think that gets the Fed to really start to act. But, you know, look where we are today. The yield on the 10-year Treasury security, as we talk, is at 160 basis points. That's not flashing red at this point.
No.
But that's something that I think, you know, the officials at the Fed are keeping a very close eye on.
So key, it sounds like key in all of this is really the Fed's messaging about inflation. If they can sort of convince the U.S. and global population that, yes, it's going to go up and then it's going to level off, and we're going to point to this GDP growth formula of number of workers plus productivity going back to basically GDP growth, ladies and gentlemen, can be measured by working hours worked plus productivity, and that gives you GDP growth. That over the next couple of years, you go 2 years out, and most economists, including the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, are looking at 1.8% GDP growth a couple of years out. If they can convince sort of the world that that's what's going to happen, then basically they will allay fears of runaway inflation. They're sort of sending a message, Jay, that yes, we're going to have inflation, but it's going to be contained and controlled. You believe them, it sounds like, but you're worried in case they might get it wrong?
Yeah, not only I believe them, but I think most other investors believe them as well. Again, if you look at the yield on the 10-year Treasury security, most investors believe that story as well. The Fed, over the last, let's call it 30 years, has built up a lot of credibility. You know, they have said we're going to keep inflation at 2% or, you know, around there. And lo and behold, over the last 30 years, it's averaged, you know, roughly around 2%. The Fed has done a pretty good job in terms of inflation over the last 30 years. So they have the credibility right now. People believe that inflation won't get out of control. And that's a big, important part of keeping inflation under control. People believe it will stay under control.
If we go
if you
ahead,
lose that credit, if you lose that credibility, if inflation does spike up and it does start to get out of control, then it's going to take. It's like credit, right? You know, it's once you become less credit worthy, it takes a long time to get trust back again. And the Fed would face the same sort of issue as well going forward.
Right. So, ladies and gentlemen, if your credit rating goes, if your credit score really falls, it takes a long while to repair that. Charlie Plosser, who was president of the Philadelphia Fed, talked about this a lot, about the Fed's credibility. There we go. And he said that he thought it was a stretch to even have a dual mandate away from just price stability to full employment. He often questioned whether they should have that full employment mandate. And now it seems that the Fed is also taking on a great level of concern about the poor, about those who have been left behind or disenfranchised by monetary policy that's created this great wealth disparity in the country. Are you seeing that trend towards, I guess, paying closer attention and perhaps doing something about the most vulnerable in society by the Federal Reserve? Does that concern you as a additional mandate or part of their mandate?
Well, you know, Michael, that's, you know, that's a kind of a, that's a political sort of question here. You know, what the reason, you know, one of the price, the reason why the Fed was given a price stability mandate was, if you go back 40 or 50 years ago, we had a very high inflation rate right then, and it was given to them to try to fight inflation. You know, as I just said, inflation hasn't been an issue over the last 30 years. What's an issue now is income inequality. And the Fed, you know, at the end of the day is, you know, it's supposed to be an apolitical organization. It's not directly influenced by politics, but there are, political pressures that are put on the Fed. The Fed was created by an act of Congress. It could be changed by an act of Congress. And if the Fed is not seen as trying to address societal goals as well, sooner or later, it could lose some of that independence. And so if inflation is not an issue right now, keeping the pedal to the metal, if you will, in terms of monetary support to try to bring the unemployment rate back down, there's political reasons to do that. And I think there may be some economic reasons to do that as well.
So my question is, in this extension to try and meet a political and societal goal, this new sensitivity, because they need to be politically sensitive, are they overreaching? Are they taking too much on? Are they promising too much and running a higher risk of eroding their credibility if they can't get one of these three things done?
Yes, they are running that risk. You know, if they keep the pedal to the metal too long and inflation does start to pick back up, then that's going to become an issue, not only a societal issue. As inflation goes up, the people who can at least afford price increases get hurt there. But it's an economic issue as well. Countries that have high inflation rates tend not to grow as rapidly as otherwise, just because when you have a lot of uncertainty as inflation, that hurts investment spending. So they are running that potential risk. But none of us know right now, right?
None of us know right now, but we've got to keep attention to that risk. And the real risk, ladies and gentlemen, if there's ever a overarching risk to the Federal Reserve, in Farr's opinion, it's the risk to their credibility more than anything else. You undermine the Fed's credibility, and we have serious, serious problems. Jay, finally, just to wrap up, and this is so great. I always learn so much whenever we talk to you, and I know our listeners do. I'm hearing a constructive, reasonably bullish Jay Bryson. Have I got it right?
Yes, I'm constructive on the next few years in the U.S. You know, we came into the pandemic with not a lot of overarching imbalances in the economy, and we're coming out on the other side of the pandemic, with an economy that's relatively healthy, and I think this thing can run for, another few years.
Jim Urio in our first segment described himself as being bullish-ish. Would you say you're bullish-ish or just bullish?
I'm an economist, so I'm always looking at the I'm always looking at the potential downsides as well. So I'm bullish-ish, I guess.
bullish-ish. I think that's got to be our title for today. Dr. Jay Bryson, along with being my very good friend for a lot of years, Jay.
Let's don't talk about that.
Let's not talk about that. Is the chief economist for Wells Fargo. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great treat. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Michael. Always great pleasure to be with you guys.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast. We will be back again next week. I'm going to Texas this weekend to speak to a group of investment bankers, give them my view on the economy and markets coming up. I'll tell you what I learned from Texas next week on the Farcast, where we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Thank you so much. Please share us on your social media. Talk to you again next week. Bye.
Thank you for joining us on this week's edition of the Farcast, and thanks to Michael's guest, Jim Urio, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Chief Economist from Wells Fargo, Dr. Jay Bryson. We love hearing from you every week, and we try to respond to all of your notes and suggestions. You can reach us at hjennings@farmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have and topics you'd like to hear us cover in coming weeks. Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all major podcast platforms. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. The information, statements, comments, views, and opinions expressed and provided in this podcast, including by speakers who are not officers, employees, or agents of Farr, Miller & Washington, are not necessarily those of Farr, Miller & Washington or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any security, index, fund, manager, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. And if we can be of assistance at Farr, Miller & Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help. And I'll be happy to put any of our listeners in touch with one of our investment professionals for a complimentary review of your portfolio and your investment goals. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. We'll be back with you next week with scheduled special guest, Jenny Harrington. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world.